Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Hey, what's up, you guys?
I'm Catherine.
And I'm Haley.
And we are Saturdays for the Ghouls,
a podcast on the Podmoth Network.
We cover all things spooky, like horror movies, true crime, the supernatural, and spooky stories.
In the most chaotic way possible.
So join your favorite ghoul friends every Saturday, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And become a spooky babe!
So spooky babes, we'll see you in your nightmares!
Are you struggling with a lack of access to captivating entertainment and media? Are you faced with constant judgment and ridicule from friends and family for your inability to respond appropriately to sensitive situations? If this sounds like you, you might be suffering from being emotionally dead inside. But it's not too late to make a change. One Nothing Podcast is a newly available treatment for being dead inside. Taken just once every 2 weeks, One Nothing could make a world of difference. By combining carefully measured dark humor to the amazing original formula of grisly fatalities, One Nothing Podcast has successfully entertained thousands of people suffering from death inside. And with access across all podcast platforms, treatment has never been more readily available. But don't trust my word. Here's some real-world testimonials from a few of our listeners currently undergoing treatment.
From consistent doses of One Nothing Podcast, my posture has greatly improved due to being kept on the edge of my seat.
The One Nothing Podcast comes on, everybody be like, shut the f*** up. I be quiet, but when the episode's over, I be talking again.
Oh my gosh, buddy. I used to be on so many medications for blood pressure, and then I listened to One Nothing Podcast episode on Kitty Genovese, moved into an apartment on my own, and haven't needed it since. That one really got my blood pumping.
You know, listening to One Nothing Podcast, I'm not constipated anymore. I'm just full of shit.
So what's stopping you from great entertainment?
One Nothing Podcast is not intended for all audiences. Listeners under 18 years of age should obtain permission from your parent or guardian before downloading. Tell your therapist if you're predisposed to whining, complaining, rating podcasts poorly, being overall combative, or being easily offended, as One Nothing Podcast might not be right for you.
So stop letting great content pass you by. Talk to your therapist today to see if One Nothing Podcast is right for you.
Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, always good to see you guys again.
Yes. Or have you listened to us again? Listen,
yeah.
Boy, I feel that, like when you say it's good to see everyone again, I feel like
It's good to hang out again. There we go.
Yes. I don't think the show existed when you were a kid, but when I was a kid a million and a half years ago, there was a show on it was a kid's show. And at the very end of it, the host of the show would bring out a magic mirror, like one of those little handheld mirrors that was just see-through. And she would say, I see. And then she would name off kids' names. And I always wanted her to say, and I see Jane, and I see Declan, and...
It is creepy
when you think about it like that. But as a kid, I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world. But I don't think she ever said my name. Oh, well. Before we get started, I wanted to just put a reminder out there that we have a Patreon. And if anyone is interested in joining our Patreon, you get some cool perks from it. And you can get ad-free episodes, so you won't hear any of the ads that we have. And then you can also get bonus episodes. So just throwing that out there. We appreciate everyone who's already a Patreon, patron, whatever you want to call it. And anybody who wants to join can also join.
Yeah. Go check us out.
Yeah. Shall we get started, Declan?
I think we should.
Okay. What are you going to be talking about today?
So in the light of Diddy being arrested in New York, I figured I would do a similar story, much more awful. Granted, the Diddy details haven't fully come out yet, but
that's hard to
talk
say.
About Peter Nygaard. Yeah, Diddy details.
That is so weird. Hold on a second. I have to look something up.
Okay.
Because this is pertinent to your story, why I'm looking it up.
Oh, okay.
And you can edit this out. It is. Okay. Funny thing. Your great aunt was here visiting, and I told her about the podcast, and she was trying to look up our show, and she was having difficulty with whatever form she was using. And she said it kept coming up to stories about Peter Nygaard. And she said, terrible man, you can look him up.
Yeah.
So here we go.
He's got some bizarre. Rough stuff.
Literally, she just sent me that message yesterday morning.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yesterday That's morning. Strange. So super bizarre that you actually did it. And I will have to send her a message and tell her.
Yes, definitely. Let her know that we're mentally connected.
Yeah.
Telekinesis or whatever they call it.
You guys are psychically
symbiosis?
Connected.
No. That's not the right word.
Something. Cool. Well,
what are you
going to
be talking about?
I'm glad that you're going to tell us about it, because I didn't look too far into it. I just Googled his name real fast. So I'm curious about the details now for two reasons. My story is one that is not about, I mean, it is about a specific criminal, but it's not just about the criminal. It is also about the law system and ethical concerns pertaining to the criminal and laws and things like that. The circumstances that I'm going to tell you about enraged the public and got people really pissed off about ethics and rules and laws, and legal experts were trying to explain everything to people. So we'll get into that in detail. But my drink to go along with this is the attorney privilege cocktail. The ingredients are The ingredients are 2 ounces of bourbon, 1/2 ounce of orjo or orgeat, however you want to pronounce it, 2 dashes. Well,
I think it's French. It's like Fourier and Fourier.
Right. And we've discussed this before when we've used this ingredient in the past, is that you can find where it's pronounced both ways. So who knows? It's that almond flavored sweet syrup. So 1/2 ounce of that, 2 dashes of Angostura bitters, and garnish with a maraschino cherry. The steps are to combine the bourbon, orjo, and bitters in a glass with ice and stir, then strain into another glass with ice and garnish. And I'm
sounds
not
pretty good. I like orjo and I like bourbon.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it needs a little something.
It does.
Like
to
dilute it, like or maybe like a sparkling water or something. But
yeah,
let's give it a try.
I'm kind of scared. We'll see. Oh, God.
It's not bad.
But it's really, really sweet.
It's super sweet, yeah. The orzo kind of cuts the fire of the bourbon, though.
It does. It definitely tames the bourbon down, but even just a half an ounce of orzo is like...
Yeah, oh. It's pretty hefty, because it's like a lot sweeter than just simple syrup, or like a strawberry syrup or something, because it's so rich.
Yeah. I'm not gonna
finish that one.
I'm not finishing that one. I kind of think that we might start like a rating system for our cocktails.
Oh, yeah, that'd be cool.
We could do like a one sip, half gone, and a bottom of the glass. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah,
we'll workshop it. We'll discuss it.
If you have any suggestions, drop them below in our Instagram or something.
Yes, definitely. We always love hearing from our listeners and our friends out there. And so please tell us if you have any wild ideas about how to name our cocktail rating system. Okay, so let's get into this wild story. It's going to take a couple of different paths because I'm going to talk about the bad guy, but then I'm also going to talk about the legal system and how it all relates. So here we go. Robert Garrow was born on March 4th, 1936 in Dannemora. I don't know. He was born in New York. He had five siblings, and his parents were Robert Sr. and Margaret. The family was described as poor farmers, but also violent. I don't know why farmers couldn't be violent.
Not a good combination.
No. Poor and violent is definitely not a good combo.
Yes.
As an adult, Garrow reported both parents being physically abusive towards all of their children, often using weapons like a crowbar or a brick. Basically, anything they could get their hands on, they would use as a weapon against their children.
A brick?
Yep. They're not winning Parent of the Year awards, for sure. His siblings backed up his claims about the abuse. So it wasn't just him saying, my mommy and daddy beat me up. They said, oh yeah, they were monsters. Sometimes the beatings were so severe that Garrow lost consciousness. It was common for police to be called to stop brutal fights between father and son. Garrow didn't always live at home, though, as his parents would send him to another farm to work and then collect any of the pay that he would receive for themselves. So they basically enslaved him to other farms and took any money that would have been paid to him.
It's fucked up.
Yeah. When Garrow was 15 years old, a particularly bad fight led him to be placed in a prison work farm. He later claimed committing bestiality with several of the animals on the farm and using a milking machine for self-pleasure.
Oh, wow.
Gross.
I hope he cleaned it out afterwards. His milk tastes a little funny. It's kind of thick.
He didn't. I'm betting
probably
he didn't.
Not.
No. I'm just taking a guess, but I mean, if you're going to do that, you're probably not going to clean it out.
How's it already curdled? It just came out of the cow.
Oh, so gross. Oh, I would gag, but no one wants to hear that. Nope. Okay. When old enough, he joined the Air Force, but he didn't have many friends in the military as he was regularly ridiculed for wetting the bed.
Ooh, in the military, that's not a good look.
Right. And he had been able to hide that fact before then because he was typically a loner. So, you know, if he's wetting the bed, but he's by himself, nobody's going to know it. But now he's in the military and everybody's sharing, you know, like common bunk room.
Dripping on the bunkmate below him.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it that way, but
they sleep in bunks. I mean, hopefully he's on the bottom.
I was thinking single layer, you know, just in one bunk room. I didn't think about like bunk bed style.
Ooh. I think every military movie I've seen, they're in bunk beds.
You're probably right. Ugh, gross. His Air Force career was short-lived when he was convicted of stealing from a superior officer after he'd only been in for a year. So he was in a year, stole from his boss, and they kicked his ass out. And it landed him in military prison in Florida for 6 months. In 1957, he returned to New York State, where he got married and started a family, having one son. His wife was apparently the first female human he had ever had sex with.
I was like, human what? It makes sense, because he's right. Fucking sheep and cows.
Right, and a milking machine. Don't forget the milking machine. You know, anything but a human. However, in 1961, he was arrested for rape. So not a nice guy. You know, he raped animals. He decided to rape people instead. So he pleaded guilty and received a 10 to 20 year sentence. However, he was paroled after 7 years. His criminal activities persisted, though, and he was accused of several more rapes, often of underage girls. Yes. Right. Yuck. In 1973, he was arrested for the rape of 2 young girls, but after being released on bail, he failed to show to the next hearing, and he was an arrest warrant was issued for him because he failed to appear for the court date. No big surprise there. That's what happens. A few weeks later, Garrow was driving down the highway when he spotted a campsite with 2 tents. The campers were 4 friends: Phil Dombluski, Carol Malinowski, David Freeman, and Nick Fiorello. He pulled his car over and approached the campers while carrying his rifle. He demanded that they allow him to siphon gas out of their vehicle for his own, but they objected to this. So he was saying, you know, give me the gas out of your car. And they were like, screw you, dude. That's ours. You can't have it.
Even though he had a gun in his hand? Sorry, you can have my gas, man. I'm not.
Right. So he threatened them, claiming that he had killed before and he would do it again. Garrow then forced the 4 friends into the woods and made them tie each other to separate trees. Phil was verbally challenging Garrow, which sparked a fury in him. So he was like, hey, you know, you're whatever, saying he was, you know, and no, you can't have our gas and everything. Well, that pissed Garrow off. So Garrow set the rifle down, pulled a knife, and then used it to stab Phil, which killed him. During that attack, David and Nick were able to get their restraints loose, and they ran to a nearby town for help. By the time help arrived, Phil was dead and Garrow was gone. He had left his knife, though, covered in Phil's blood and his fingerprints. So they knew who he was based on that. A search for Garrow began with several sightings across the area and a couple of near misses at catching him. He evaded the police for 11 days until he was spotted near the woods by one of his sister's homes. He ran from the police, but was shot several times in his attempt to flee, and he was taken into custody. Garrow was shot in the foot, arm, and back. His injuries caused him to be partially paralyzed, which would play a factor later during his incarceration. Before being tried for Phil's murder, though, police also had a feeling that Garrow might be responsible for a couple of other crimes in the area. A couple of weeks before he came across Phil and his friends in the woods, a teenage girl had gone missing when she was walking home. She was 16-year-old Alicia Houck. Her family had received no contact from her body had not been located, and there was no trace of her after July 11th. Police were concerned that she had been kidnapped and murdered. But they had no idea, like, any details. I mean, she was last seen, you know, and then there was nothing. No trace of her. So they were just assuming, because there had been no contact with her, that she had been kidnapped and murdered, but they really didn't know. Garrow was living in the same town as Alicia. Then about a week later, a murder victim was found at a campsite in another New York town. This victim was Daniel Porter, and he had been camping with his girlfriend, Susan Petz. Susan was nowhere to be found, though. Daniel's death was eerily similar to Phil's death. Daniel had been tied to a tree and stabbed. So, of course, police are going, Phil's death and Daniel's death, very close, but what happened to Daniel's girlfriend, Susan? They couldn't find her. No trace of her either. Seeing the similarities between the crime scenes, police obviously wondered if Garrow was responsible, and they were questioning him, but he refused to talk. Well, he wouldn't talk to the police about it, but he talked to somebody else.
Of course he did. They always do.
Right. He decided to tell his attorneys about it. His attorneys were Francis Belge and Frank Armani. Although they asked him about it a few times, he kept silent. They kept trying, and eventually he told them some interesting details. He told them precisely what had happened to both Alicia and Susan. I'm going to spare the graphic, terrible details because I don't want to talk about it. But I'll just shorten it to the simple fact that he sexually assaulted each one of them and then he killed them. He told his attorneys specific details of where he placed both of the bodies for Alicia and Susan. Garrow had deposited Susan's body in an abandoned mine shaft, and Alicia was left hidden in a cemetery. The attorneys were curious about whether their client was telling the truth, so they decided to do some investigating themselves. Using detailed descriptions of the locations of the bodies, they were first able to locate Susan's body in the mine shaft. They took Polaroid pictures of the body and the mine shaft. On a different day, Belge went to the cemetery without Armani and was able to locate Alicia's remains. Again, he took pictures, but he also handled the remains, moving the skull closer to the body so he could get them both in the picture together. Because her head, they think, had been pulled off by scavengers. So he found the skull and put it closer to the remainder of her body so that he could take pictures of it. Pretty nasty. It put the attorneys in a tough position. They had conclusive information that confirmed their client had killed two additional victims, disposed of their bodies, and that he murdered another camper, Susan's boyfriend. Obviously, he knew all of the details of everything, so, you know, he's now on the hook for that. But the problem with it is that he told his attorneys. And that applies to attorney-client privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So this privilege provides that communications between a client and their attorney are protected and confidential. The purpose of this privilege is for obtaining or providing legal advice. And it prevents lawyers from being forced to testify against their clients. It also encourages clients to fully disclose all information to their attorneys without the fear that it will be revealed to anyone else. So this helps ensure that clients receive the best legal advice and representation. It sounds great if you're a criminal and you want to confess to stuff, but not great for the victims or their families, because Alicia and Susan's families are just sitting wondering what happened to the girls. And Garrow's not telling the cops. He's only telling people that can't tell on him.
I mean, yeah, it makes sense. If I killed someone, that's what I'd do.
Right. So let's get back to the crime. Enough about the legal ethics stuff. But back to the crime that led to Garrow's final arrest. which was Phil's murder. In June 1974, the trial began. Garrow sat in a wheelchair during the trial due to his partial paralysis. Although doctors were not necessarily convinced the paralysis was real, Garrow insisted it was, of course. A physical exam was done before the trial that indicated he was likely faking or at least exaggerating his symptoms. The doctors were like, they were not buying it. They were like, no, this is bullshit. This guy has full capability. But because he was like, no, I'm really paralyzed, they had to, you know, allow for him to carry out his act. Garrow testified on his own behalf, and he discussed his childhood traumas, sexual past, and his extensive criminal history. He gave testimony about the crimes that he had done when younger, the rapes that led to his first prison sentence, and the rapes of the two girls for which he had jumped bail. He went into details of his crimes, including telling the court and jury about Alicia and Susan's abductions, sexual assaults, and eventual murders. So now he's finally admitting to those things. So they, you know, could definitely hold that against him, but he's now admitting it to everyone, not just his attorneys. He described how he had killed Phil and Susan's boyfriend, Daniel. He testified for 3 days. What likely shocked the jury was when he admitted that he had told his attorneys about Alicia and Susan, explained how they had taken pictures of the bodies, and showed him for confirmation purposes. So he is just opening his mouth and telling everybody everything about everything they want to know, which kind of seems weird to do when you're on the stand and you're trying to hide stuff, yeah. But, you know, it makes you wonder why he was testifying to all of that. I mean, it made him look terrible, but his attorneys were hoping that all of his stories about his personal trauma, all the stories about his crimes and the things that he had done, they were hoping it would make the jury think he was insane, because their plan was to get him an acquittal based on insanity. Which,
it's not an acquittal, right? You still go to an asylum for that?
Possibly.
Like, you don't get freed because you're insane?
Yeah, but that's what they were hoping. They were hoping they would say not guilty by reason of insanity. Which,
definitely shouldn't let an insane person back onto the street. That's all I'm saying.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, okay. Even if you think he's insane, he just admitted to multiple murders. Why would you say, oh, okay, yeah, let's put him back out on the street because he had a hard childhood and he did some crazy shit and he did bad stuff. Let's just let him out again. That was their whole plan.
It's a pretty dumb plan.
Right. However, he ended up being convicted of Phil's murder, and he was sentenced to 25 years to life. Soon after the sentencing, the public became enraged by the knowledge that his attorneys knew the locations of the bodies before anybody else did. Because remember, he told them where, they took pictures so that they could confirm it. But they didn't tell anyone that they knew about it. They didn't tell anyone where the bodies were. They just made him testify to it in court. So people were pissed off. But on both sides, people were upset about, you know, everything that happened. The general public wanted to know why the attorneys kept the information secret, but legal experts sided with the attorneys, explaining that attorney-client privilege was actually a law in most states at the time. Apparently, it wasn't a law everywhere, but in that, I think it was like just a couple states were left at that time in 1974 and 75 that it wasn't a law, but it was still an ethical concern for them. In February 1975, the case was brought to a grand jury to be evaluated for any potential criminal charges to be brought against the attorneys. Belge was indicted for violating health laws regarding a speedy burial of a body, but those charges were later dismissed based on attorney-client privilege. So them keeping secret was upheld, but initially they were like considering it. The grand jury did not approve any charges against Armani, but the stress of the situation caused him to have a heart attack. He did survive it, though. But let's get back to our POS criminal that brought us here to begin with, because the story is not over there. So he began his prison sentence in maximum security, but he repeatedly petitioned to be moved to a minimum security facility that was specialized in the care of the elderly and handicapped prisoners. Remember, he got shot and he's partially paralyzed. So yeah. He gets to go to a minimum security facility. His request was eventually granted in September 1978. Garrow had a plan and he got help from his son. His son came for a visit, nicely brought a bucket of fried chicken, but at the bottom of the bucket was a gun. I don't know how you smuggle a gun into prison in a chicken.
When
bucket,
was this again?
75. Oh,
yeah, they definitely have like metal detectors or something there.
Yeah, 1978. They should have fucking found it. It was a gun in the bottom of a chicken bucket. Come on. Garrow had created a dummy for himself out of rags and wire, which he placed in his bunk. He tucked the gun into his waistband and he walked out the door of his cell. Since he was located in minimum security facility, the handicapped, no one challenged him because they were like, oh, he's partially paralyzed. He can't walk out. Who's that guy? I don't know. Must not be Robert Garrow. I don't fucking, it's insane. He left the building and nobody said shit to him.
Jesus. Just walked. How do you even walk right out of a prison? Like, oh, sorry, I got trapped in here somehow. Like, right. Let me out.
It's crazy town. He climbed the fence and made his way to the nearby woods. The next morning, guards discovered his escape. A search quickly began, but officers were concerned that Garrow was long gone. Because the prison sits near a major interstate highway where he could have easily hijacked a car or been picked up by someone. Nearby towns were searched as well, but there was no sign of the escaped prisoner. For 3 days, dogs, helicopters, specially trained law enforcement officers conducted searches, including the woods near the prison. During one of the searches, a radio was located that had been registered to Garrow, so they intensified their search of the woods. Garrow was hiding in a hole in the ground covered by leaves until one of the officers got too close. Then he jumped out of his hiding place and started shooting, hitting one officer in the leg. However, he wasn't the only officer in the area, and Garrow was quickly shot to death. In the end, both attorneys were cleared of any wrongdoing regarding withholding the information, but many people were left angered by the situation. And Garrow was no longer alive. Because he was a big faker. Yeah,
sounds like the best. Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's for the best.
For sure. Just crazy.
Yeah. Prison break stories are always interesting to me. I heard a similar one, like, I was listening to the Honeydew.
Yeah.
The Patreon Honeydew.
Oh,
and
okay.
He just interviewed a women's correctional officer. Oh. And he said somehow, like, this older lady got a hold of a nurse's outfit and just walked right out.
Again, just walked out.
Yeah. Like, how'd the nurse get in there to begin with? I'm sure they have a sign-in sheet. Like,
oh,
who
my
came
goodness.
In and who's coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They should check that.
Anyways.
Shit.
Anyways, wow. Let's get into Peter Nygaard.
Yes.
Pekka Juhani Nygaard was born in Helsinki, Finland on July 24, 1941. Pekka and his parents moved to Manitoba, Canada in 1952 to escape the war. And since he moved to Canada, Pekka decided to change his name to Peter to assimilate better. After graduating high school, Peter moved to America. Peter did well in school and graduated from University of South Dakota in 1964. After school, he was hired by a women's clothing firm in a program called Young Executives. Over the course of a year or so, Peter was able to buy a majority stake in the company, making him the lead executive. He changed the company's name to Nygaard Fashions. The clothing was sold in major retailers such as Sears and his own retail stores. And at the time, Sears was a big store. So
right. They were...
Now it's not. Now you can only buy fridges and shit there. But
right. Yeah. I mean, back in the day, Sears was like... They
were huge, right? Because
they, yeah.
They had the Sears catalog and you could order it from mail. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big deal.
Nygaard was interested in growing his company and invested in a technology that linked manufacturing with clothing demand. So when stores sold more of one item, he could make more of that item. So like,
oh, fancy.
Like, yeah, he was a pretty good businessman, just not a good guy.
Oh.
At this point, Nygaard's clothes were mostly sold in Canada, but he wanted to branch out to America. So he found a small retail company that sold women's sportswear. He made a verbal agreement with the owner to have his clothes sold in their showroom floor for a 50-50 split, but shortly after this agreement, he essentially did a hostile takeover, kicking out the original owner.
Hmm. That's yeah. Not nice.
And since it was a verbal agreement, there was no writing. She basically got right. Fucked over. Yeah.
What a dick.
Shortly after the takeover, his clothes were sold in 30 states, leading to 60% of his revenue. The National Labor Commission issued a report on Nygaard's clothing manufacturing plants, and it was not good. Mm. The reports claim that Peter's clothes were being made in sweatshops in Alzarka, Jordan. The sweatshops held 1,200 people who were trafficked from Sri Lanka, India, and Bangladesh.
Not nice.
Workers had their passports confiscated and forced to work for little to nothing.
Oh,
so they were just trapped there.
That's awful.
Yeah.
I don't really want to make a joke about sweatshops because it's terrible, but did they make sweatpants?
Yes. And yes.
Sorry. I can't help
women's sportswear.
Oh.
They were forced to work 18-hour days and paid half of what they originally offered.
Yeah.
After the report came out, Peter's company released a statement saying the passports had been returned and the workers got one day off a week and were being paid more. So they're still working 6 days a week.
Probably
super long
still
hours,
working
but
18-hour days yeah. too. Oh, yeah. But I got my passport now, and instead of a dollar, I got paid $2.
Yep.
Fuck that guy.
The conditions were still horrible in the factory, but this wasn't the only so-called sweatshop that Peter owned.
Oh, I bet. Well, you got one that's working well. Why don't you just have more?
Yeah. So on August 2nd, 1995, labor officials raided a small residential condominium in the town of El Monte after an employee escaped through a ventilation shaft. Fucking Mission Impossible shit.
Yeah. Holy moly.
The condo was surrounded by barbed wire fences and had iron bars over all the windows. Inside, they found 72 workers from Thailand. The workers were told they would have to pay a small fee to make it to America. However, when they arrived, they were forced into slave labor, working 17-hour days, being paid anywhere from 50 cents an hour to $1.60.
Holy yeah. shit. Don't have sweatshops,
workers were...
people.
No. Especially not in America. It's easy
right.
to get caught here. The workers were treated, or sorry, the workers were threatened, beat, raped, and even killed. Smugglers brought the people there and forced them to work to pay off their travel fees, which ranged from $4,000 to $25,000. Yeah.
How do you set that fee?
Just making it up in their head, I bet.
Yeah.
It's like, you came from Thailand in this area. I guess that costs $25,000, sure.
Holy.
So among owning horrific sweatshops, Peter was also a sexual predator.
Of course he was.
He was arrested multiple times for these crimes, but the victims never testified, leading to the charges being dismissed or dropped. In 1987, Peter used his ever-growing fortune to buy a property in the Bahamas. Similar to his sweatshops. Huh?
Is he like the original Epstein? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
You'll see.
Okay.
Similar to his sweatshops, Nygaard would traffic workers from other countries to work on his estate in the Bahamas, many of which were underage female employees.
Yuck.
Yeah. Nygaard would often be seen fondling himself under his bathing suit while talking with his staff. He would host lavish parties and invite celebrities such as De Niro and Michael Jackson. There's like a huge list, but it's kind of hard to find it. But yeah, there's a bunch of people that were also connected to Epstein that had been to those parties. So you can just kind of figure it out. Yeah.
Okay.
In 2014, Peter had become very interested in stem cell research and helped fund some of the studies, flying to like China and stuff to like learn more about it. Okay. This is where it gets super fucked up. Mm. He would impregnate underage women on his property, force them to get abortions, and use the aborted fetuses to extract stem cells to inject into himself.
Oh, Lord Almighty, what the?
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah.
Super fucked up.
This is... How have I never heard of this guy before yesterday?
I don't know.
He got better PR.
Well, I'll get into when he... He got arrested like fairly recently for how old he is. He's like 70 years old, I think, like when he got arrested.
Jeez.
So in 2015 and 2017, Nygaard was investigated by the FBI over claims of sex trafficking to his Bahamian
estate
in 2019.
Too much of a word for me. Too many letters.
He was also investigated by Homeland Security for this as well. On November 24th, 2019, Bahamian police began investigating six allegations of sexual assault made against Nygaard. All of the alleged victims were under 16 at the time of the alleged assaults. Additionally, on the 27th of January, 2020, Nygaard faced two separate lawsuits after being accused of sexual assault. On February 13th, 2020, 10 women filed class action lawsuit against Nygaard in New York, alleging he had sexually assaulted them in his estate in the Bahamas. The alleged attacks took place between 2008 and 2015. The women also alleged that he maintained a sex trafficking network and that seven of the women were under 18 when the attacks took place. So seven out of those 10 in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. The following day, the Bahamian police started an investigation into Peter's estate. Several days after that, the FBI raided Peter's New York offices in connection to sex trafficking. By June 2020, additional women came out against him, totaling 57 plaintiffs.
Wow.
Yeah. On December 15, 2020, Nygaard was arrested in Winnipeg for extradition to the U.S. to face charges of sex trafficking by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. On the 5th of February, 2021, Nygaard was denied bail and faced extradition to the U.S. And in September of 2024, a court in Toronto sentenced Nygaard to 11 years in prison for four counts of sexual assault. 11 years?
What?
Come on.
Okay. Yeah. I'm putting on my pissed off face. What?
Yeah, 11 years for sex trafficking, for assault, for all those fucking charges.
Ugh. Wow. Yeah. So this just happened. His conviction.
Yeah, it's fucking crazy.
I wonder if he's eligible for early release or if he has to serve that full 11 years. Because if he's 70 plus... He's probably not gonna.
Hopefully,
get
stabbed up in there.
How?
Chris Hansen, just started a new show all about this guy.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never heard the name.
Have a seat. That guy.
Never heard the name before. Yesterday.
Yeah, super crazy. He's like a billionaire too, so it.
Wow.
Just like Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
Only he did it in the Bahamas instead of the Caribbean, I think.
Well, the Bahamas are in the Caribbean.
Oh, well. He's just like Jeffrey Epstein.
just a different island, sounds like.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Except for I don't think Nygaard was an operative of the state. But
Not that we know of.
I think Jeffrey Epstein was.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, that's a very disturbing story of Peter Nygaard. You should look up a picture of this guy. Oh, he looks fucking crazy.
I did.
Yeah,
I saw a picture of him. That long white hair.
With the like puffy fucking Botox face.
Oh,
he looks like a witch.
So gross. Yes.
Yes. He's making stews and catching Hansel and Gretel and shit.
Oh, what an awful monster of a... Yeah, you can't even call him a human being because a human being is no. Yuck.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
No, he's not a cool guy.
Uh-uh. And a billionaire should have, if it sounds like he's got a pretty good PR person, if they're hiding all this shit that's been going down for decades, he should have had them tell him that his hair was atrocious and that he looked like a witch from
he looked like a
fairy
freak.
Tales. Awful. Just awful. Ugh. Okay. Do you have a chaser that's gonna be good?
I do.
And make
this
awful taste in my mouth from that dirt bag go away?
So I've got a watch recommendation. It's a movie called The Instigators on Apple.
Oh.
And it's got Matt Damon and what's the Affleck brother that's not Batman?
Casey Affleck?
Yeah, it's got him and Matt Damon and they pull off a heist that goes extremely wrong.
You know I love heists.
Yes, it's such a good movie. I watched it the other day, and I might have to watch it again this weekend.
Cool.
That's how good it was.
Put it on the list.
Yeah.
I like
it. What's your chaser?
My chaser is an article that I found from the Good News Network, and it is about a cat burglar.
Oh, okay.
Yes. A town in England has been missing a bunch of its clothing, but the suspect is not who you would think it is. The perpetrator is a cat, for real, who goes into people's yards. The cat has even broken into people's homes.
Jesus.
Probably through like an open window, and has stolen like socks and gloves and clothing. And if the cat steals a sock and it only steals one sock, it'll go back and steal the matching sock.
Yeah.
So you have a matching
cat. That's funny.
Right. So it's a cute cat. It's a little black and white tuxedo cat.
I think I saw this story.
In the article, it's super funny that there's a picture of the cat, and the cat is staring down the camera like, go ahead, take my picture. I don't give a fuck. I'm going to steal your socks, and I'm going to take them for myself. Screw off. Those are my socks. So apparently the owner posts pictures of the stolen items on social media so that people that are missing their stuff can come.
You can come get it back.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I thought it was super cute.
Yeah, I like that story.
Definitely a good chaser for our awful stories. We both had terrible stories, but, you know, hey, that's the show, right?
Yep. And you guys listening, subject yourself to it every week.
Yes. We love it that you are willing to listen to us tell terrible stories to each other.
Well, I think that just about wraps up today's episode.
It does. Nice chatting with you, bud.
Yeah, thanks for joining, everybody. Love you, Mom.
Love you, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.